Welcome to the Exalt Podcast. My name is Christopher Chagnon.
And I'm Sophia Hagalani Alba. This month, we are super excited to be joined by Tim Oakes, who is a professor from University of Colorado at Boulder. In fact, he was also one of the keynotes at the Finnish Society for Development Research's Development Days that we had in February of 2022. So we are super excited that he is gracing us with his presence.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Sophia. It's great to be here. Thank you for the invitation.
It's an absolute pleasure to have you on here. I remember when we were setting this up, I had mentioned that like my background has focused a lot on China. So I'm really extra excited to have somebody who's China focused on here as well. I'm going to try not to nerd out too much to keep it understandable for everyone at home. But it's such a pleasure. Would you mind introducing yourself for our audience?
Yeah, I'm Tim Oakes, and I am a professor of geography at University of Colorado Boulder, and I'm a human social cultural geographer. I've done research for a long time in China, and so, yeah, I'm a China nerd. So if you want to nerd out later, that's great. And I guess I should add, not only is my research focused on China, but most of my work has been done in Southwest China in a province known as Guizhou, which the keynote that I gave earlier focused on some work that I've done there. But I've been working there, I guess I could say, since the late 1980s. So I've, you know, when you work in China for that length of time, it's quite amazing to look back and think about the place that you first visited compared to the place that it is now, and how difficult it is to recognize how much change there's been, and to be able to see that over the course of a research career, I guess, is also, you know, pretty amazing. And despite the efforts that I've made to broaden my research focus to different parts of China and different places, I keep going back there. And I think part of it's just because just the amazing fascination of looking at how those changes continue today. And you never know where things are going. And so I keep going back. Unfortunately, I haven't been able to go back since 2019, and doing research in China has become more difficult, not just because of COVID, but because of geopolitical relations and U.S.-China relations more specifically. So whether or not a lot of fieldwork there is in the near-term future remains an open question, but I hope to be able to keep going back.
Absolutely. Well, I know that you and Christopher both had a lot of engagement with China. I have to admit that I'm not as aware of, you know, obviously in a casual sense, I'm aware of, you know, some of the things that have been going on in China, but not in the research or living there capacity. But I did go there once. I visited China in 2008. Which was a quite interesting trip. I went around to a few different cities. I think it was in advance of the Olympics. That sounds right in terms of the timing, right?
Yeah.
But I'm super interested to learn more. You mentioned that there have been changes that have taken place since you first visited China in the 1980s to what you now see in China today or in 2019. Tell us a little bit about that. Like, I'd love to hear about what some of those changes that you've seen are.
Yeah, you know, where to start, but I guess I could just start with my own kind of experience of that. And that is, you know, when I first started working in China, my research focused on rural development. And I spent a lot of time in villages. I was younger and I had a little more stamina at the time, because rural research can be difficult in all sorts of ways. It's also incredibly rewarding just to be able to spend time in those places with the people. And I was really, you know, for a long time interested in the way that villages and people living in rural spaces were trying to kind of take control of their own modernization, of their own development, the ways that they were trying to be agents of their own change. And that really fascinated me. There were contradictions in that, as they started to realize, you know, because some of the things that I was looking at were things like ethnic tourism development and heritage tourism development and ways in which the countryside was becoming a space that particularly, you know, not just foreign tourists or foreign visitors, but people in China's growing cities, China's emerging middle class, were interested in visiting for recreational or aesthetic or cultural reasons. You know, and this is in the context of a country that for a long time, and in many ways still does, regard its countryside as backward and impoverished and lacking development, lacking modernization. And so tourism was seen as a way to kind of change that narrative. And I was really interested in how villagers were, you know, trying to not just embrace that narrative, but to manage it for themselves, for their own gain, and not just, you know, a broader tourism industry or government or something like that. And the contradictions that I mentioned were around this thing where in order to modernize, in order to develop, you had to kind of display yourself as primitive, as authentic, as unmodern, in order to kind of get a bit of urban middle class culture, so to speak. You had to be as exotic as possible. And how did people in rural China learn to do that? How did they learn to put themselves on display in a way that would work for them? Was a question that I was really interested in, and was also interested in trying to, you know, work with those people to kind of help them understand why that's an important question, right? And so, you know, you asked about change, and I guess where this is going is that as I, you know, the more time I spent in rural China, the more I saw urbanization happening in those places. And so whereas the initial development that I was interested in was about, you know, increasing incomes and changing people's livelihoods in ways that, you know, were oriented around tourism, for example, or craft production or something like that, the biggest change that really started to become apparent was that these places were increasingly connected to and becoming part of the space of the city, the space of urbanization. They were becoming urban hinterlands. They were becoming part of a process of what geographers would term, you know, urbanization in place, or in-situ urbanization, or rural urbanization, or something like that, where the countryside is kind of, it's not, urbanization isn't just a process of people picking up and leaving the village and going to the city, but it's a process where the village itself starts to become urbanized. And so, you know, I started to realize that if my interest in China had started with the countryside, I was increasingly aware that I couldn't avoid the city. And so I started doing more and more research on urbanization and urban development and urban things. And so that's one of the most fundamental changes that China has experienced, I guess, is the scale and rapidity and extensiveness of urbanization. And that's, you know, a lot of what I talked about in the keynote. Just, you know, what does that look like, and how does that shape experiences when the place you live, the countryside you live in, starts to turn into something else that is part of an urbanizing process, but may not result in something that is recognizable as a city.
There's so much to unpack there. From my own personal experience, I can appreciate what you mean and understand what you mean by this sort of tourism, the rural tourism. I lived in Qingpu district in Shanghai for a while, which is like kind of the outskirts there. And there is a lot of farmland, but like there were restaurants that I would go to and stuff that were farmer restaurants. And, you know, you could catch your own crayfish in the like little thing. And I mean, the owners were lovely. We got along really well, but they made most of their money off of people from downtown, like traveling an hour or two to take their kids to the countryside and pick some corn and roast it themselves.
It's kind of a Nongjia Le.
Exactly.
Right. Which means, I don't know if you translate these things, but you know, it's actually a difficult term to translate. Happy farmer household or peasant happiness or something like that. But yeah, that's really common rural tourism platform.
Such an interesting thing. And I think of like going to Guizhou, like must be truly the more upper middle class. But I'm really curious, like looking at this, that playing up of the simplicity of the countryside or the like ethnic minorities really playing up their exoticness. I'm kind of curious, how has this changed over time? I mean, because of course, you know, one of the things you brought up in your presentation was how for so many decades, like people from those areas, especially would travel to like major industrial centers on the East Coast, work for months at a time, go back for spring festival, and they don't have to do it so much anymore because of this sort of growing urbanization. So I'm curious about how that's impacted people's feelings about themselves and these sorts of industries.
Yeah, that's such a good question. I mean, there's so many different things to say about that. I'll start with just this idea of cultural authenticity or exoticness of the countryside. I mean, and for the areas that I was working in, that was particularly that was a particular focus of the tourism there because these were ethnic minority villages that I was working in. And Guizhou province has a high portion of ethnic minorities, you know, so China is made up of officially, at least there's the government has official nationality categories and there's 56 of them. And the largest is the Han, and they constitute roughly 92% of China's population, and the other 55 are the minorities. And about a third of Guizhou's population then is made up of minorities, and they're predominantly rural. And so when ethnic tourism starts to develop in this area in the 1990s, it's the minority groups, it's the minority villages that are the real attraction here. People are really interested in exotic minority practices and cultures and those kinds of things. And these villages kind of become open air museums in a way. And one of the things that I noticed happening, you know, as rural urbanization starts to happen, but more specifically, the big infrastructure push that really starts beginning around the early 2000s with the Open Up the West campaign that begins around that time, and the building a new socialist countryside campaign. These are state central policy initiatives that focused a lot of development resources on kind of the frontiers and the hinterlands of China, where ethnic minorities tend to predominate. And so that resulted in constructions of highways and all sorts of transport connective infrastructures that really changed the whole ways that people interacted with the countryside. You know, when I first started working in these areas, it was a long, arduous, full day journey from the provincial capital to get to one of the particular villages where I was staying in, for example. And by the mid, you know, by 2005, 2006, that journey had been cut to a couple hours on a new expressway, a highway, which had lots of bridges and tunnels and things like that. And so it made those villages accessible in a way that they hadn't been before. Whereas before it was like, you're really going on a journey and it's a long way and you're going way out into the mountains and you're going to see a really exotic village that is the opposite of everything you think of as modern and Western and whatever. When you can get there in 2 hours, your disposition towards that space really changes a lot as a visitor. And what I started noticing is a focus less on cultural authenticity and ethnic exoticism and these kinds of things, you know, difference, in other words, cultural difference was no longer on display as much as just recreation opportunities, right? These villages became, Chris, like you were talking about in Shanghai, a place where you could go and, you know, catch a fish in a pond and you knew it was going to be clean and good to eat and organic or whatever, you know, because you were out in the countryside and this stream going by is fresh water and there's no pollution in the air and these kinds of things. And so the villages really became these spaces for recreation. And if it was an ethnic village, that was a nice backdrop to that experience, but it was no longer the objective of that experience, right? It was more about, you know, just going and having a nice lunch or something like that. That change really, you know, was enabled by the infrastructure development that occurred. And I remember at one point I was talking with some of the villagers, one of those villages that I'd done research in the early 90s, and I was back there, you know, 10, 15 years later, and observing this kind of change in the way that they hosted visitors. And, you know, the villagers were like, well, this is much better because, you know, it was a lot of work back then to kind of perform our exoticism in that way. You know, we'd have this very fancy reception routine and we'd play music and we'd sing and it was a big deal. And it would take a lot of time away from our work in the fields and so on. And, you know, now not as much is demanded of us as cultural performers. And you know, we're more entrepreneurial about the businesses and we don't have to be exotic. We just have to provide lunch. And so it was interesting to see that attitude because, you know, earlier, they had been really focused on, how important it was to promote their identity as Miao or Dong or, you know, one of these minority groups. And, it was a much more transactional attitude that they had. And maybe that sounds unfortunate to some listeners, you know, that was, you know, that's too bad. They've become, I don't know, more modern in that way. But for them, it was a much easier way to pursue a livelihood than what they'd been doing before.
It's amazing what an impact the introduction of infrastructure can bring to place. I know that from my perspective, I've always lived places that have, you know, a very robust infrastructure. For example, in the US with the highway system, or here in Finland, the infrastructure is, you know, it's in place already. It's there. I can't imagine kind of being there to witness the shift of like mm-hmm. the rollout of infrastructure. So tell us more. I want to know more.
I mean, you know, the next phase of that after the highways get put in is the high speed rail. And if you thought that the highways changed everything spatially in terms of how people get around and how they think about space, the high speed rail just upped that to an exponential degree again, which was, you know, again, amazing to see. I mean, let me go back to the highways first, and then I'll get back to the rail in a minute. But one of the things that was so fascinating about what the highways did was they created a view space for people traveling along the highway. And those people traveling along the highway would be relatively well-off middle-class urban people who had their own cars, you know, for example. And political leaders in the counties and the countryside areas, the townships and so on, that the highways passed through, realized that they needed to put on a good display within that view space. And so a lot of effort, a lot of money, much of it actually spent by the villagers themselves. And in fact, large amounts of debt were created because of this. Because village families felt like they needed to do this or were compelled to do this by local officials to refurbish their houses, basically, or put a kind of, you know, I call it like a facelift on their houses to make them look sharper, to make them look better. I mean, if you spend time in a village for a while, you realize that a house is an agricultural tool, just like any other, right? A house is not just a place where the family lives, but it's where animals also spend time. It's where you store your grain. You know, so a house is a tool, and it's not something that's necessarily meant to look tidy. But with the highways going through, local leaders thought that the villages should look more tidy, especially to people passing by in their Volkswagens and their BMWs and so on. And so a lot of money was spent on tidying up and making this village kind of visually pop. And it was a way in which the countryside became more, you know, transformed into something that was aesthetically, visually appealing to a kind of an urban middle-class mindset. of what they felt like a village was supposed to look like. And so these highways, I've always felt that they, you know, not only was this infrastructure making an impact on accessibility and so on, but it was also an agent of, and maybe this is a bit harsh to say, but I think it's an agent of a kind of an urban colonization of the countryside. It was an agent of, and that colonization was as much aesthetic as anything. It created indebtedness on the part of the countryside, but it also created a reshaping of the landscape of the countryside along the lines of what an urban aesthetic kind of recreational leisure class would want to see as it goes by at 100 kilometers an hour. So the infrastructure had that kind of impact as well. And then when we get to the high-speed rail, you know, it's really interesting because if the highways were limited access, the rail lines are even more limited access, right? There's only so many stations that they put in. And one of the villages where I had done dissertation research back in the early 90s was, again, you know, like a two-day arduous journey from the provincial capital to get there when I was doing research there. And it just happened to be located right next to one of the new high-speed rail stations that they put in on the rail line from the provincial capital down to Guangzhou along the coast. And so that two-day journey turned into an hour on the high-speed rail. So that village all of a sudden was super connected, not just to the provincial capital, but to Hong Kong, to Guangzhou. I mean, you could get there from Beijing in just a matter of hours. And, you know, obviously that just changed everything in terms of tourism there exploding and again, a whole kind of national profile or national scale of development occurring there. But the places that are not nearby those high-speed rail stations in some ways become more isolated than they had been before. When everything is oriented towards an older network of older roads and so on and so forth, then those places are seen as, yeah, they're relatively accessible, just like most of the rest of the villages in that region would be. When the high-speed rail comes in and everyone's thinking about accessibility changes according to the rail network, those places then become isolated in a way that they hadn't been before. They become kind of forgotten. They become a place that nobody really wants to deal with. And in fact, you know, there's been efforts by the Chinese government to, as part of rural development efforts, to actually depopulate large portions of the countryside that are not going to be as connected with the new infrastructure networks as they had been with older networks in the past. And so there are active efforts to move people, to resettle them to other more accessible areas. There have been some studies that some Chinese scholars have actually done, not in Guizhou, but in neighboring Yunnan province, of the impact of high-speed rail on relative connectivity or isolation of villages. And they found that the rail line created more inaccessibility than accessibility on balance. More places were further away from accessible points than the places that were closer to the station. And so in some ways, there was kind of a net negative effect on accessibility. And for, I think, a lot of government officials, that's the point, right? That justifies the need to resettle large portions of the countryside. That infrastructure network, in other words, links urban nodes together. And if you happen to be part of the countryside that's along that link, then you're part of that urban network. And if you're not, then you're outside of it. And that outside is really outside now.
That's such a, I guess, like visceral image, thinking of these places that have been so remote in their way, but being able to use, I would guess, like, you know, some roads or even like going further back, because I mean, these are not like newly populated places, like even footpaths, yeah, or something like that, to now being somehow more remote in more modern times, but also, yeah, picking people up and moving them to places that I would also imagine were probably not very populous either, to suddenly have like, okay, everyone in this big area, you're going to move here now.
Yeah.
Has that created like tensions? Like, or I'm curious about this because I feel like people have to be unhappy about being more isolated and possibly unhappy about moving. But the people who with the that their village is the one that's like more connected now, but also they have a ton more people coming in, and it's also very fundamentally changing. So has there been like resistance to this, or like how do people feel about it on both ends, the ones who are forced to move or are encouraged to move, I should say, and the ones who are in the place that people are moving to?
Yeah, I mean, that's the great question, and it's a really hard one to answer. You know, even if you're doing research in these areas, the question of resistance and people's attitudes or criticisms are going to be very difficult for people to talk to you about. So you have to kind of assess those kinds of things from a distance based on, you know, other things that you see happening in news reports and those kinds of things like that. But what we can say, I think, is yes, there's definitely resistance to that, or there's definitely at least people who are not happy about being relocated. On the other hand, I mean, you also have to understand that many people are, at least maybe if not happy, are certainly willing to give it a go or to do what needs to be done to give their families or their children or something like that a chance to have a better life than they had in these places, more isolated places. So, you know, I've encountered the whole gamut of attitudes and opinions in areas and in the different times that I've worked in these spaces. But I qualify that by saying, you know, I don't think that people are talking to someone like me about a lot of their concerns or a lot of their problems. I mean, I do hear some of that, particularly in places if I'm able to spend a long enough time there and kind of generate a sense of trust among people who will open up a little bit more. But most of my research has focused on, or most of what I've heard from people have been, yeah, you know, it's hard. We don't, you know, we don't really like it when our village is demolished and we have to move into relocation housing. And you know, we have problems with compensation, and they're not giving us a fair deal with what we feel like we should be getting for our land or buildings or things like that. Or, you know, they promised us a place to live, and you know, they demolished our village, and yet the place they promised us to live was not, you know, it took them 3 years to build it, and we had to kind of fend for ourselves. And, you know, there's all sorts of conversations that people have had with me about those kinds of problems. And yet at the same time, most of them have said, you know, this had to happen. The life we were living before was not sustainable in terms of, there was no pathway to the future for us. There was no way to see how a farming lifestyle was going to lead to a better life for our children down the road. I mean, they were going to have to leave, right? And they were leaving, and they people were leaving the countryside in droves to work, you know, as you said, right? You know, to go to the cities to work in factories and come back once a year during Spring Festival or something like that. You know, that was not sustainable for people. And they said, you know, something has to change. And so, yeah, we need to, this is really hard to go through this, but most of the people who I've you know interacted with would say that they're willing to go through those changes. And if there is resistance, and there is, it mostly focuses on the smaller questions of you know adequate compensation, or you know, were there local officials skimming, you know, money off the top of what was supposed to go to families for relocation expenses, you know, corruption and those kinds of things. There was less resistance related to the bigger issue of, you know, changing the whole kind of economic and social structure of the countryside and reorienting it around urbanization and urban development. People were for the most part all for that. You know, the other thing I would just throw in relationship to, you know, poverty eradication efforts and its relationship to infrastructure. I mentioned the studies that had been done in neighboring Yunnan. And it's interesting because Guizhou and Yunnan are two, you know, neighboring provinces. And Yunnan has, at least until recently, seen a lot more emphasis and investment in these kind of larger scale connective infrastructures. There's been more of that more recently in Guizhou. But before a lot of that was being developed in Guizhou, there's a scholar named John Donaldson based in Singapore, and he did a really interesting study comparing poverty relief in Yunnan and Guizhou. And he found that it was more effective in Guizhou because they had to work on a smaller scale with the smaller roads, the little dirt roads. You know, before they were building high-speed rail, before they were building expressways, you know, what infrastructure investment there was went to making sure that this village was connected with a little dirt road. And most of the investment in Yunnan, on the other hand, had from an early point gone to the expressways and those kinds of things. And so he found that the smaller scale, the little dirt roads were far more effective at providing meaningful access to markets, meaningful ways for laborers to find work in the region and those kinds of things. And didn't really cost very much, you know, to build those roads. I think there, despite everything I just said about people saying, yeah, you know, we're happy to have the city come to us and to kind of try to link into this big infrastructure network that's on a national scale, that's going to kind of plug us into where development modernization is happening. There is an alternative to that. Right. There is an alternative that that focuses on small scale local roads connecting places. You don't need to move everybody out of the countryside in order to create conditions of poverty relief. You can just rethink what kind of infrastructure and at what scale you want to build. And unfortunately, I think in China, what's happened is just a real focus on that large scale, that national network. And a lot of the people in the countryside are really left with the choice of either you either leave, you know, you either find some way to become part of that network, or you're just outside of it and everyone forgets about you. One of the things I mentioned in my talk, you know, was the what I called the hacker roads, the ways that villages that have not been included in a highway interchange, for example, to get access to one of the new highways that goes by, have just built their own sometimes. And they cut through the guardrails and they just build their own on-ramp. So it's like they're hacking into the system. They're hacking into the network to get that accessibility because they don't really have any other options. But there are things that could have been done on a smaller, more local scale that I think would maintain a countryside that was viable as a rural space. And not just as a service space for the city, but that hasn't happened as much.
Oh, chills. I mean, like that sucks. Ooh. The countryside, I think, I mean, in China, I'm getting a picture in my head from like the descriptions that you've given, but I mean, in so many places, the countryside is a space that it's like, what do we do with it? You know, like even here in Finland, there's been, you know, a lot of kind of questions about what to do with the modern countryside. Like, what is the life that people want here in the countryside? And I think that it's actually really interesting. I mean, obviously the Finnish countryside and the Chinese countryside are very different places, but you mentioned how one of the places where you've done your dissertation research, they got that train station. And where I've done my dissertation in the Finnish countryside, they've actually lost their train station. Right. So one of the things that's happening in the Finnish countryside is like, places are losing those train stations because there's just not the same amount of traffic, especially now that people have cars, so many cars. But I think it's really interesting. Like, once again, I kind of said this earlier, but this conversation is really making me realize that maybe in my own life, I've really taken some of that infrastructure, like the road infrastructure, for granted. Like, yeah, roads, they're there, right? Like,
yeah.
Sure. And I know that, like, for example, once again, when I moved to Finland, one of the things that really surprised me was, like, in the Finnish countryside, which if you haven't been to Finland, well, you've been to Finland, but for our listeners, if you haven't been to Finland before, the countryside starts really quickly after the city. There's not a lot of kind of in-between space. You kind of go like city, countryside. And one of the things that always really surprised me, even in like the very closely communicated Finnish countryside, was how quickly it went from paved to dirt roads, which is something growing up in California, like, yeah, there's dirt roads like in parks, you know, like there'll be a dirt road there. Like if you're really far out, you know, maybe between the fields, there will be dirt roads, but for the most part, residential roads were always paved. But here in the Finnish countryside, unless it's a very, very main street, a lot of them are still dirt roads. And I just, like I said, this whole conversation is just like really making me feel like maybe I am taking some of the infrastructure for granted, and also like not realizing how many myriad impacts there can be.
So a couple things about that that are so interesting to me. I mean, one is I just, you know, dirt roads are important. I mean, I think that just needs to be said, right? It's important, not just because there's a road there. And this, I'm not just talking about China here. I don't know the Finnish countryside so well, but, you know, I think here in the US, in the Western part of the US, I think that's true as well, where it's not just a question of, is there a road there that's linking this place to other places? You know, and if so, if there has to be a road, then a dirt road is better than no road. But the other issue is that a dirt road is better than a paved road in many ways, because it's small. It limits, not so much limits access, but it's done at a scale that is appropriate, I suppose we could say. And it works. And people want their dirt roads to stay dirt roads in a lot of places. They want to be connected, but they don't want to be too connected, and they don't want the kind of so. And this leads to your other point, which I think is so true of taking the infrastructure for granted. And when we start to actually think about, and here we can, you know, we can clarify that, you know, we're thinking about connective infrastructures of roads and highways and trains and these kinds of things. Scale matters so much, and hierarchies matter. So one of the things that, you know, that developed in my own way of looking at urbanization and what was going on in the countryside in China, as I started to pay more attention to how infrastructure was driving these changes, was to think about exactly what you're saying. It was like, let's not take that infrastructure for granted. What happens when we start to focus our analysis on the infrastructure itself? You know, what kinds of questions do we start to ask? How do we start to understand the changes going on when we start to see infrastructure at the center of all that and not in the hidden background? I mean, infrastructure in some ways is supposed to be hidden, right? The designers and builders of infrastructure want it to be taken for granted. They don't want people to think about it. And yet, as scholars, I think we have an obligation to kind of turn that around and say, what do we do when we put the infrastructure in the foreground and think about it as an analytical tool, not just an object of research, but as an analytical tool itself? Because infrastructure is not, of course, it's not just a road that we're talking about. It's not just a railway or a highway. It's a whole kind of assemblage of social relations and technical expertise and policies and all sorts of things that have to come together and that swirl around that road or railway. The fancy term, the jargon that we use to say that is, you know, infrastructure is a socio-technical assemblage, right? So it's not just it's not just a technology, but it implies or it entails social relations and social connections. And because of that, there's a politics to it. There's a cultural aspect to it. So when you start with the infrastructure, you start seeing those social relations, you start seeing those politics. You know, for example, you start seeing politics in the spaces in China as being about, not about, you know, are you for or against the Communist Party or the government or anything like that? But can you connect to the network or not? You know, that's the political question. You know, are you left out of the network? You know, Chris, you were asking about resistance. And, you know, we have certain conceptions about what political resistance is or is not about. You know, we have ideas about human rights and, you know, all these kinds of I would call them more conventional ways of thinking about politics. But when we start with the infrastructure, those political questions, I think, shift a little bit to a different kind of politics that's very real and very much part of people's daily lives, but sometimes goes a little more unseen or unrecognized. You know, when people look at a place like China and they think politics, they're not really thinking about whether or not somebody has access to a highway. And I think that, you know, that's not just about China, right? That, like you said, I think those are probably politics you could find in Finland as well.
And, you know, everywhere. I think, you know, if you look at the history of like westward expansion in the US and like, you know, railroad expansion and all the politics and money politics around that sort of stuff. Very, very, very long and storied history. And yeah. I mean, I think there's so much here. And I think also like one of those interesting things with China too, of course, is the power of the federal level in terms of the like massive infrastructure projects. Like, cause I remember back in like 2008, 2009, the massive high speed rail and highway building to, you know, counteract the global financial crisis and also to like, right, you know, spread prosperity to the West.
Right.
So I find it so interesting. And I think like, you know, looking at these projects and like how these policies have evolved over time and continued over time, like what you've been working on most recently with Guiyang is such a fascinating case study. So would you mind telling our listeners a bit about Guiyang and how this comes together with the infrastructure?
Yeah, Guiyang is a what in Chinese is called the translation is a national new area. Like you said, Chris, it's at that national scale. It's the state council it designates these. And so a national new area is basically it's like a special economic zone, sort of. The very first one to develop in China, to be developed or designated in China, was Pudong, that the big development zone on the other side of the river in Shanghai that now has that fantastic futuristic, still kind of futuristic looking skyline where all the tallest towers in China are located and everything. Anyway, that was the very first national new area. It was designated in 1992, I think. So Guiyang is one of those. It's the eighth one that has been designated. It's a big area, about 1,800 square kilometers, right in the middle of Guizhou province. And it's meant to be an experimental zone for the development of big data technology. It's basically, you know, what the government did was kind of strong arm China's mobile data providers to locate their servers there. So Alibaba and Tencent and China Mobile. So it's one of the two largest cloud data centers in China. The other one is actually up north in Inner Mongolia. And it was a good place for that because you know, data servers use a ton of energy and servers need to have certain kind of climatic conditions to run properly. And Guiyang has a lot of limestone caves in that area and limestone hills. And they found that building, housing the servers inside these limestone caves or building tunnels essentially in these limestone hills was the perfect climate to kind of run these servers without needing a ton of electricity to keep them cool or keep them warm or something like that. And then there's a lot of hydropower in Guizhou. And so electricity is relatively cheap there. And so, you know, those were some of the practical reasons for focusing on big data in this area. But then they also wanted to kind of experiment with the ways that big data and kind of algorithmic forms of governance could be marshaled in the effort to battle rural poverty. What role could tech companies like Alibaba, for example, play in marshaling big data resources and technologies to combat rural poverty? And here the obvious kind of answer was, you know, turning villages into kind of e-commerce platforms where villages would kind of shift from agricultural to some kind of e-commerce production that they would sell directly to consumers via Alibaba. You know, they would do live streaming and these kinds of things. And so Guiyang was meant to be a center where those kinds of technologies would develop, and Guizhou was meant to be the province where there would be a lot of impact of that. They also focused on virtual reality and artificial intelligence, development in the area as well. But essentially what Guayan is just a big kind of urbanizing area where they've kind of built industrial clusters and new kind of high-end residential places. They've got a new high-speed rail that goes through there and a fancy high-speed rail station and all sorts of new highways and new connectivities. And my work there and my interest has really been focused on how does daily life for most of the people who live in that area, how has that changed as that development has occurred? And these are, for the most part, rural places, rural people. The Guayan area is located between the provincial capital and not the second, but maybe the third largest city in the province, a city called Anshun. And so the new area is kind of sandwiched between these big urban centers. And so most of the land is rural. It's not super densely populated, but there's maybe, I don't know, maybe 500,000 people living there in that area, which, you know, it's not very many in China. So I've been really interested in how people living there, how their lives have changed in relationship to this development. And I've focused a lot on, and as I mentioned in the talk, on the fact that, you know, when they're developing this new area, the first thing they do is they go in and lay down a kind of an infrastructure grid of highways and boulevards and big open avenues and things like that. That's where a lot of the central government money comes in, where they do that. And so you get this really odd kind of landscape of transition. I think it's meant to be transitioned anyway from a kind of a rural-based agricultural kind of society to an urban wage labor kind of based society. And the infrastructure grid is supposed to be the kind of the first step in that transition. And then it's kind of up to everybody else to figure out what to put alongside the roads, so to speak, for the city to kind of develop and grow after the grid is put in. I've been using the term infrastructure space to talk about what this new area is. And I could talk at length about what that term means, but I won't bore you with that right now. But I want to point out that I've used that term because this is a landscape that's on the one hand, it's not a landscape that I've seen in China before. It's not really the countryside anymore. It's not a city. It's something very different. And it is kind of in transition. It's changing, and yet it's not really changing into a city. And even the planners and developers and officials there will say, yeah, we're not building just another city. We're building a whole new way of thinking about what urbanization is. And it's not going to look like your normal city. It's more like a kind of a big high-tech campus with some villages still there, but the villages that are still there, most of them, you know, about three-fourths of the villages in the area are being or will or have already been demolished. The ones that remain are mostly just kind of showcase recreational villages where people can go and have a nice lunch and something like that. But nobody's really farming in this area anymore, not in any meaningful way. And so it doesn't really have a kind of a agricultural quality to it. And yet it doesn't have the density or other kinds of things that we typically kind of think of as a normal city, so to speak. So it's a landscape that's difficult to name. It's not rural, it's not urban. Our categories aren't adequate to name what this kind of landscape is. So on the one hand, you have this kind of odd landscape, and yet that is unlike anything I've seen before. And yet on the other hand, it's increasingly the kind of landscape that you see all over China. This kind of space between cities, this kind of space on the extensions of cities, on the outside of what we typically think of as your proper city or your real city. This is where urbanization is really happening now. And this is more and more more and more large swaths of China are now living in these kinds of spaces that we don't really have a name for. Infrastructure space is what I've come up with for the time being to kind of think about what this is. But You know, interestingly, a wonderful scholar, Abdulmalik Simon, has got a new book out that he where he talks about these kinds of spaces as, and he calls them the surrounds. And I won't go into the theoretical and really interesting things he has to say about this. But you know, these are kind of spaces of extended urbanization that are kind of half built. They're, people are kind of living half lives. There's odd juxtapositions of kind of village and industry. It's a space that he talks about that eludes any kind of coherent narrative of change or development. And so that to me is just so fascinating to kind of see this emerge. And again, you know, I have to admit that I haven't been able to spend time there for the past couple of years, and I've only been able to kind of view the changes through WeChat and through news reports and those kinds of things from a distance. So I'm less conscious of what it looks like today than it did a couple of years ago, but it's still it's still a really interesting space that I think is increasingly going to define what urbanization has become in China and other parts of the world as well. One of the things I mentioned in the talk was, you know, the scholar Henri Lefebvre, who wrote a lot about urbanization, and he wrote about something he called the urban revolution, where he said, you know, the global capitalism has moved from it's not in industrial production that capital gets reproduced and circulated as much as in urbanization and urban development. And so part of his argument was that when we look at cities, we're looking at a particular spatial or material manifestation of a particular moment of urbanization. But urbanization is a social process that continues as capitalism changes. And so I think what we're seeing in places like Guiyang is the kind of the latest material manifestation of this new phase of urbanization that's happening not just in China, but around the world. And that doesn't really look like a city. It looks like something else, but it's definitely part of the urbanization process. It's just not resulting in the kinds of places that we're used to urbanization resulting in.
So not all urbanization necessarily means skyscrapers and
right.
Really dense city blocks. Now, right. Just a question, and this might be completely off base, but just out of curiosity, swimming around in my head when you were talking, but do you think that maybe some of this kind of like new manifestation of urbanization in China is happening because there are already such like densely developed urban spaces, and so maybe this is just like they've done what they can do in those urban spaces, and so it needs to kind of come out in a different way? Or am I completely off base here?
No, I think that's really true. I think there has been a deliberate effort on the part of the government to shift urbanization away from cities. I think partly that's just we were talking before about the unsustainability of people moving from the countryside to the city and leaving their kids behind. And, you know, all of that has been, people in China recognize how the high social cost that has. But it's also, you know, the government's own kind of sense that they don't want, you know, everybody wants to move to Beijing. They all want to move to Shanghai. They all want to move to Guangzhou. And all along, the government has been really wary of what we would think of as over-urbanization, which, they would look to places in Latin America or South Asia or something and see a lot of, you know, cities that have swollen to vast size and yet don't have the services and don't have the kind of way to deal with those populations in any kind of orderly fashion that governments, of course, like to have a lot of order. And so there's been a deliberate effort to make sure that urbanization in China happens more in the smaller scale cities and the towns, and of course in the countryside. If you create urbanization in places where people are leaving, then maybe they won't leave. And in Guiyang, we've been seeing that that is happening. That's the case. People have reasons to stay now. And so, I think you're right in that there's been a recognition. Yeah, the cities are big, and there's a deliberate part of what's going on with the national new areas like Guiyang is that in 2014 China released its first ever urbanization plan. In English, we call it the so-called National New Type Urbanization Plan. Urbanization has been going on in China all along, of course, but it wasn't until 2014 when there was a formal actual plan for urbanization that was laid out. And one of the things that plan stipulates is focusing away from established urban centers and creating more of a set of clusters of cities that are, and what defines a cluster is infrastructural, so that a cluster of cities is a space, that doesn't take more than an hour to get to any particular part of that place, so that it's meant to be a vast labor market that can be accessed within an hour, 1 hour commute time. And that's where the high-speed rail comes in as, helping to manage that. And then the high-speed rail network is really developed as part of the urbanization plan, because the high-speed rails are meant to kind of link these clusters together nationally. And that's where the focus of the high-speed rail development really is. So all of these are ways in which the government has really tried to kind of divert urbanization away from cities and towards new kind of urbanizing spaces. But as a result of that, I think you have these spaces like Guiyang that don't look like cities in the conventional sense. And I think are emerging as for better or for worse, as something else that may work for some people in some ways and may not work so well for other people in other ways.
That's so interesting. Like, I mean, I really appreciate you kind of responding to like my thought earlier about like if the cities are kind of, if they've done what they can do. But the next question that kind of comes up in my mind is like these spaces, these kind of new urbanizing spaces that China has been building, is this something that they're just doing in China, or is this also happening on a more international stage?
Yeah, I mean, that's the question everyone wants to know in some respects. And that's what I want to know too. And I think, ultimately that's where my own work is heading. But there are people who've been working on these kinds of things, particularly, for example, in Southeast Asia, plans to build a new city on the outskirts of Yangon in Myanmar, ways in which new cities are emerging out of the special economic zones that China has been a big player in developing, for example, Sihanoukville in Cambodia. So there are instances where China has very much been involved in what looks like new city building, right? And I think this partly comes out of the fact that what China is known for in the global kind of development marketplace, I guess we could call it, is special economic zones. China's famous for Shenzhen, right? And maybe Pudong, we mentioned Pudong as well, what Shanghai has kind of turned into. But what China is known for on the outside is like building these instant cities, like the myth of Shenzhen, which is a myth. It's not really true, but the myth of Shenzhen is like there was nothing but a fishing village. And then 20 years later, there's this 20 million person, metropolis that's just built from scratch. And the idea that governments around the world and the global South would look to China and say, can you build us one of those? That'd be great. We'd like one of those. And the Chinese developers going, yeah, sure, we can do that. As a development actor, China is, famously pragmatic and, really good at saying, yeah, we can do something under budget and in half the time that anybody else would build this thing in. And so, yeah, China is being looked at as a source for not just building a new city, but a new way of thinking about urbanization, again, a new kind of city, right? And partly that's because the cities that are getting built are often emerging initially out of the special economic zone, out of an industrial zone, out of a port that was initially set up as a purely an infrastructure space, purely a space for intermodal transport development or logistics, a logistics hub or something like that. But one of the things we see with what China often kind of tries to do and develop with these spaces is create a much more comprehensive kind of development space that does involve urbanization, that does involve city building, that does involve real estate speculation and so on and so forth. Now, the important thing to think about with China, though, is that it's easy to kind of assume that there's some kind of grand strategy or China model in which there's a blueprint that says, you know, we need to build a certain kind of city and this is how we do it and this is what it's going to look like. Whereas the reality is much more both kind of more complicated and more mundane, where these developments emerge out of particular circumstances that are particular to these specific sites where they're built and the needs of the local governments that want to build them, and also of the different agents, the different actors involved, different corporations, different development agencies or development companies. Many of which actually are not Chinese at all, but are, you know, China, a lot of the city building that China does employs design and architecture firms and construction firms from the West. And so these are much more complicated kinds of developments than what they might appear to be on the outset. So to say that China is kind of bringing a particular model of urbanization to the rest of the world, I think is a bit premature or a bit misleading, because I think it misses the fact that China has to work within the constraints of the places where it's doing these developments. And that's a very different context and very different constraints than what they have faced or dealt with in a place like Guizhou, which is within China, right? So that changes everything in ways that people are often a little less aware of. So to get back to your question, is China building these kinds of things? I think in some ways we can see a lot of similarities with the new kinds of urban spaces that are proliferating outside of the major cities in a region like Southeast Asia. I don't think that's necessarily because China per se is part of that process. I think that's part of a much broader process of how urbanization is changing around the world. I think that's part of the way capitalism is changing, not so much the way China is kind of foisting itself on the developing world.
Absolutely. And, you know, there are so many huge and important points there that I would love to jump into, especially like with my own background looking at the Africa-China relationship and infrastructure development and seeing these things playing out so many different ways. And then also pulling my hair out, hearing the popular media narratives in like in Finland or in the US or in the West generally of like, China's right, imposing their will on everyone. And it's like, well, and the, of course, the histories of where these things come from. But I know that you have to get about the rest of your day. We've been taking up a lot of your time very joyously on our side, taking up a lot of your time, but maybe one day you could come back and we could delve even more into these different types of issues.
Yeah, that would be great. I would love to do that.
But I guess to wrap things up, at the end of every episode, we always like to ask our guests the question.
A question? Are we going to ask a question?
So we always like to ask the question, which is sort of a call to action for our listeners. It could be something they could like do in their daily lives. It could be something that they could read. It could just be something that they can think about. But do you have anything for our listeners that you would recommend for them if they're hearing this and they're really interested and want to do something.
Yeah, and it is just something to think about. And I wish it was more of a call to action, but I think we could always use more thoughtful reflection in some ways to accompany that action. And I think it does just extend from you know what I've just been talking about in terms of, you know, how we understand China as an actor. You know, I mean, you're right about the ways that mainstream media, and particularly, you know, here in the US at least, not sure, sir, about Finland, but a lot of really nasty rhetoric coming from politicians that really isn't about China at all. It's just about saying certain things that will get them more votes and so on. But so in that context, I think there needs to be a little more responsible thinking about how do we understand China as a international actor. That's something that we haven't had to do in the past. China was always over there doing what it did for itself. And now this situation is different, where China is very much a player in the global, not just in terms of global development, but in the global economy. And not just because so much of our products on our shelves come from there, and that they buy a lot of our stuff too, but because, you know, investments are now coming from China. Chinese companies are now building things all over the world. How do we think about that? And I think the tendency has been to go straight to kind of some kind of cultural essential kind of thing. Well, you know, the Chinese must do things in a very Chinese way, and there must be a particular China model of development. And if we could just kind of unlock the key to understanding what the Chinese are thinking and what they're up to and how they're different from everybody else, then we'd have it all figured out, right? And that is such a irresponsible road to go down, right? In terms of how you want to think about China. So a couple things. One, there is no monolithic China. There are many, many different actors involved in China's international profile. There's different kinds of companies. There's different kind of government agencies, government levels. There's individuals. So there's no monolithic actor, and not everything is coming from Beijing in terms of some particular agenda. There's a whole bunch of different agendas out there, most of which have to do with making money and having some influence as well, but there's a lot of different things going on. And so I think the third thing is, and this is the most important, I think, is that China is an actor situated within global capitalism. It is not outside of that. And so a lot of the ways that we might think about what China is up to are ways we need to think about what capital is up to, what capitalism is up to, and how China is now part of that system and doing things in some ways, different ways that the development actors from the US or Europe might do things. But it's always important to remember that what China does within that system makes sense within that system. Not because of some cultural kind of essential differences between China and the rest of the world, but because that's the way the system is working now. And so when you see labor exploitation going on Chinese projects abroad, and you want to say the Chinese are hiring, you know, and they're hardly paying any people, that's a capitalist issue. That's not a Chinese issue. That's an issue that is facing capitalist development in many ways around the world. And here I'll even go, you know, when you see the way Chinese are treating Uyghurs in Xinjiang in Western China, you need to remember that that's in some respects, not entirely, I mean, and not to absolve responsibility for certain, you know, government actors and things like that for atrocities and terrible things happening. But, you know, Western capitalism is involved in that in important ways through, you know, product supply chains, through technological mechanisms and apps and these kinds of things. This is truly a global world that we live in, and China's part of that. And so think about that when you think about China as a player in that world. It works within capitalism, not outside of it, and usually not against it. So I'll leave you with that. Sorry, that's a little morose, but but this has been a really fun conversation.
No, it's absolutely okay. We can leave it at a serious point because, you know, we do talk about real issues here on the Exalt podcast. So like, absolutely no problem. This is actually not the most morose place we have left a podcast episode.
Good to know.
I mean, thank you for that. And I think, I mean, you brought up so many incredibly important points that I would love to continue diving into for the next several hours. But I think that you really brought out so many important things there that are really a lot of people don't think of because, you know, China has always been so on the periphery of Western thought. Yeah, thank you. It's a fantastic answer to the question.
So if any of our listeners want to find you, is there anything that you want us to link to other than like your official university profile? Like, are you on Twitter or anything like that?
I am on Twitter. Yeah. I'm at @TS_Oaks. Or that should be pretty easy to find on Twitter. I'm not a super active tweeter, but I'm on there. And then you could also link to the ChinaMade website. So that's ChinaMadeProject.net.
Fantastic. We'll definitely make sure to put that down in the show notes. Echoing everything Christopher said, if you make it back to Helsinki, we definitely have to like make sure to meet up over a little bit more casual space and talk about these things more. And hopefully we'll be able to have you back someday in the future, because I feel like this conversation, even though we went a lot of places and talked about a lot of things, it barely scratched the surface. So thank you so much for joining us.
Well, thank you again for the invitation. And it's been a real pleasure to talk to you. And I've just really enjoyed my time talking with you, and I enjoyed my time very much in Finland, and looking forward to both being able to hopefully do this again at some point in person and to spend some more time with you in conversation. It's been great. So thanks so much.
A huge thank you to Tim Oaks for coming on and sharing such a fascinating conversation with us. Please join us next month when we will be talking with Syed Mustafa Ali and Dan McQuillan about Luddism, social change, and anti-fascist approaches to AI. From the budding trees and lengthening days of Helsinki, Finland, I am Christopher Shagnon. On behalf of Sophia Hagelani Albov, thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.